So, we talk about holy orders. Any question about holy orders? No question. Everything clear?
We have a friend whose brother left the priesthood.
Uh-huh.
What happened?
Now, of course, the holy order is like baptism and confirmation. When the person receives the sacraments of holy orders, you know, the mark on the soul is for life. That one can never be removed. Now, sometimes for serious reason, the church allow a man to be released from the duties of the priest, you know, so that the person lay aside. So the person, of course, free from the duties of the priest, but also do not have the right of the priest anymore. So it's living as a lay person, cannot exercise the priesthood anymore. But because the holy order is still there in the person's soul, so in case of urgent necessity, the church supplies the faculty. Let's say somebody dying, nobody around except a laicized priest. Then at that moment, the church gives that person the faculty to absorb, to hear confession, to give the sacrament. Yeah. So it's
If he left the priesthood because he was lonely,
uh-huh,
and then got married and had a family,
uh-huh,
then what happens to his soul?
Only God can judge, you know. I think it's some situation, the person may be in a situation, you know, that is extremely difficult, and so in a situation that when the person apply for laicization, the Holy See grant a dispensation. So I think, you know, that the person when he apply, you know, is something really have a good reason to do that or not. I think that's really important. So if a person just doing that for selfish motive, you know, I think it will be running a big risk for the salvation of the souls. If somebody is in a really difficult situation, you know, only God knows how difficult the person have gone through. So I think in some places, you know, in some situation, in my heart, I think it might be not quite the person's fault, because I know, you know, in here we are fortunate, the seminary is doing a pretty good job. People go through mission, you know, they make it to the priesthood, really few of them actually left the priesthood. But, you know, in some seminary, they do have problem in their training. They have difficulty, you know, in their faculties, in their professor. And they are not teaching the proper stuff to the seminarians. So I know in one particular seminary, they have, I forgot the exact number, they have maybe 1 year, they got like 13 ordained. Within a 5 years time, or 6 years, you got a good portion already left the priesthood. What is that telling you that they are not properly formed.
Yeah.
So in that situation, they are not properly equipped, and so they are going through a really tough time. You know, it can be not their fault completely. It can be the fault of the seminary. They are not being formed properly.
Maybe it's not their vocation and it was not identified for them.
Yeah, so whatever the reason, you know, of course, it's hard for us to judge, you know, what's going on, because we are never to that diocese, to that seminary myself, and thankfully I'm not there, you know, because it's horrifying to know the number. Some of the seminary, you know, they have that class of priests being ordained, and a few years later, good portion of them no longer active. You know, there's something wrong when that happened, you know. So I think in this diocese we are fortunate to have a seminary that is pretty good, and so the priests generally I heard people comment that people go through mission, usually the number of them leaving the priesthood is a pretty small percentage.
Is there a curriculum laid out for the seminary?
Usually a person must have gone through at least 2 years of philosophy, so you know how to think well. And then 4 years of theology. And then in theology, the big three will be dogmatic theology, moral theology, and scripture. Those are the three big subjects. And then the other one will always like flying around, you know, like canon law, and then the liturgy, and then also pastoral theology, and then you have church history, the history of the liturgy, and then you have spiritual theology, So all kinds of different subjects, also early church fathers, they're just throwing all around you. But every year, the big three are those three, you know, dogmatic, moral, and scripture.
Is there a body that oversees in the church what the curriculum should be in the seminary? It's like someone in
the Holy See have the Congregation of Catholic Education. So I know that when Bishop Miller was the secretary there, the congregation also oversees seminaries. I have to check, maybe I think now it's changed to be under the Congregation of Clergy that oversees seminaries. I don't know if it's still under Catholic Education Congregation, maybe it's under the Congregation of Clergy. So there's a Holy See congregation that oversees the seminaries in the whole world. And then of course, kind of trend want every diocese to have a seminary. In practice, it's difficult because some dioceses are small. So usually now in Canada, it's like a number of dioceses have one seminary. Like, so Western Canada is mainly in Mission and also in Edmonton.
Can you ever switch dioceses?
It's possible. It's possible. Some seminarians, they do that as seminarian. They switch diocese. By switching, they might just left the diocese and then study as independent for a while and then just join another diocese later on. So it's not as dramatic, you know. But as priest, you cannot just left and then independent and then join another one. Because as priest, if you are a priest to exercise your priestly function, you need to be always under somebody. It's no feline priest, you know. You always have to be under authority. So if you are incarnated to a diocese, you do that as a deacon already. You can be on loan to another diocese. And then if you are on loan to another diocese, you work there for 5 years and you like that place really much, you want to be there permanently, then the two bishops have to talk among themselves and they agree, so you can excarnate from one diocese and incarnate it to another diocese. Yeah, that can happen. So sometimes it can happen, you know, a diocesan priest feel a deeper call. He want to become a religious. So there have been this situation, diocesan priest become a Franciscan or even become a monk. That happened from time to time. So sometimes there can be some going around a little bit, but it's usually that's not a common thing. But from time to time that can happen. Yeah. And then some people, they might from a Salesian, a teaching order, to become a Benedictine, to a monastic order. That also happened before. And also still happens from time to time. Yeah. Yeah.
People talk about the magisterium of the church.
Uh-huh.
Are there specific bishops that are assigned to the magisterium, or is that all the bishops that are there?
All the bishops and the pope, they all, you know, part of the magisterium, the teaching authority of the church. Of course, there are some bishops that are more especially looking after the purity of doctrine within the church. So we're the congregation of the doctrine of the faith. That's the congregation especially, you know, focusing on the doctrine. But magisterium as such is the whole body of bishop and the pope together. Mm-hmm. Good questions. Any other questions? Clear as a mother? Good. Okay. The sacraments of holy matrimony, 338. Basically, in here, bless you. So, marriage is already around when Jesus was born. So what Jesus did was that he elevated the marriage between two baptized persons to a sacrament. So if two people are baptized, and then so when they got married and there's a true marriage, then it's a sacrament. Okay? And then, If it is a marriage between a baptized person and a non-baptized person, or two non-baptized persons, then it's not a sacrament. It's still a marriage, but it's not a sacrament. It's only when two are baptized that it's a sacrament. So if it is a non-sacramental marriage, and then, you know, one of them, they left, you know, well, this one cannot live in peace without offense to the religion, then the church have the authority to dissolve a non-sacramental marriage in favor of a sacramental marriage.
What if an unbaptized person marries a baptized person? It's unsacramental. But what if a couple months later, an unbaptized person gets baptized?
Then it's automatically become a sacramental bond.
So that's like with me and my wife.
You are sacramental bond. It's for life.
We were married before.
You are married before you get baptized. The woman you got baptized is automatically become sacramental. And then if there have been sexual intimacy after the baptism, then the sacramental bond is consummated, then no power on earth can dissolve that marriage. Now, because marriage is a sacrament, if especially when two are baptized, it's a sacrament, right? When two are baptized, it's a sacrament. So if people are baptized and they want to get married, they should, it's a sacrament, so they should, like other sacrament, they should not receive a sacrament in the state of mortal sin. So if somebody have a mortal sin and want to get married as a sacrament, the person should go to confession first, you know, and then get married sacramentally. And also it's important that for Catholic, you know, a Catholic should marry in the Catholic Church. Catholic should marry in the Catholic Church. And so, sometimes it can happen, you know, people maybe didn't know that a requirement, that something necessary, so they marry outside the Catholic Church. Later on they find out, oh, we wasn't married in the Catholic Church properly, then should have the priest do the ceremony for you. It's a simple ceremony, you know. You basically can be only five people present, the priest, the couple, and two witnesses. And then they exchange the vow, and then they marry properly in the Catholic Church. So it's important to get it done. So when now in here it's about the effect of the sacraments of matrimony. So there is increase of sanctifying grace, the life of the soul increase. But also the special help of God for husband and wife to love each other faithfully, to bear with each other's faults. That's important, huh? And then also to bring up their children properly. This is the special sacramental grace obtained from the reception of the sacraments of matrimony. Yeah, to bear each other's faults, right? Brother Ross and Sister Kim.
He's laughing a little bit too hard.
Yeah. Okay. Next page. Duties of the of married life. So they should be faithful to each other, provide in every way for the welfare of the children God may give them. So husband and wife must comfort and support each other in the activities of their common life, in the fulfillment of their duties, individual as well as mutual, in all important matters, both spiritual and material. Now they are no longer two, but one flesh. So support each other, mutual assistance. And then husband and wife must be faithful to their marriage vows. They owe fidelity to each other. They ought very carefully to avoid even the appearance of unfaithfulness. For where jealousy is awakened, conjugal, how do you pronounce this one?
Facility
ends. They should bear with each other's faults and infirmities and not ruin their home life by dissensions.
No
bossiness. No bossiness. Okay.
This is very, very dated. Matt is the breadwinner. The woman should take care of him.
Yeah. The spouses should always live together and have a real Christian family life. They must, however, remember that all maternal relations must be in accord with divine and natural law in the faithfulness of chastity. For its type and model, marriage has the mystical union between Christ and his church. The husband should love his wife as Christ loves the church, with a holy and supernatural love as his own self. The wife should love and obey her husband as the head of the family. Yeah. So it's a challenging concept. But you know, Pastor 11, he say that, you know, it's different a function. You know, man as the head is this, you can think about that way, because men tend to be protecting and providing. So that's what mean by head. And Pastor 11 say, if man is the head, the woman is the heart. Heart, you know, give warm and love, you know. So
he
that's
has the
important.
Power to turn the head.
How to turn the head. Yeah. So it's so that's the different function, you know. So I think it's still that men and women is you know, complementary to each other, you know. We are not quite the same, you know. We are equal in human dignity. But I think like sometimes women can see things that we men cannot, you know, see.
Sometimes.
You know, lots of time, you know, lots of time, you know. Yeah, lots of time. Women can see things that we men cannot see. And then, you know, so I think it's a balance, you know, it's helping, it's like, you know, we are not complete as individual. We always need some other people to help us. And then we talk about contraceptive is evil, you know, we talk about that and we talk about the sixth commandment already. So in here, they also talk about contraception, abortion. Back in the old days, this book was produced in the good old days. They talk about those kind of problems already, right? So it was a problem back then, you know. So it was a problem back then when people have that mentality that sex is not mainly for love and life, but for pleasure, you know. That mentality is something that caused so much evil in society. But it's back then already is there. So they need to address that in those days already. And then the next page talk about divorce, you know, because God institute marriage as something permanent. So God doesn't like divorce. It's human who created divorce. When people have a divorce, you know, to attack the marriage bond, that's sinful. That's not right. Sometimes people have to file a divorce to protect themselves. That's something that if it is for protection, but not to attack the marriage bond, then it's something that, you know, the church tolerate, you know, that kind of situation. And of course, oftentimes people, after they have divorced, if they want to marry again in the church, they will have to apply for annulment to look into the first marriage, that the first marriage is null and void because of a significant defect. Or they have to apply for the Pauline, you know, because the first marriage is non-sacramental. So it's up to the church to dissolve the first marriage in favor of a second marriage. And often the second one is a sacramental marriage. And it's also, another situation can be a bit, seem to be uncommon, but it can also happen is that the couple got married, maybe also, immigration reason, whatever reason they got married, but they never lived together. If they never lived together, you know, that the marriage covenant is never consummated, then the Pope can still dissolve that, non-consummated marriage, because they never lived together. So that's a bit special situation, but that happened from time to time too. That they may be getting married, you know, a lot of the motive, one of the main motive maybe for immigration. So they got married civilly, but validly, maybe they are not Catholic, and then they never live together, you know. So in that situation, if one want to become Catholic, the Pope can dissolve the first marriage. Okay, and then the next lesson on lesson 166 is about the church law about marriage. Yeah, it's important to understand, you know, of the baptized people, we are more under the law of the church than under the law of the country in the matter of marriage. You know, all authority comes from God. Both the state, the country authority is from God, but also the church authority comes from God. But, you know, in the matter of marriage, the church have more authority from God than the government. So, what authority has the state regarding marriage of baptized person? The state has the authority to make laws concerning their effects that are merely civil. So, material, you know, about property, tax exemption, stuff like that. But the Catholic have to, you know, we obey the law of the country as long as this do not contradict the laws of God or of the church. So for Catholic, a simple law I mentioned already is to have a true marriage before God and the church. It must be, to have a true marriage, it must be done before an authorized priest and two witnesses. So if a Catholic is not married in the Catholic Church properly, they should ask the priest to do a convalidation to get the marriage done in the church. And then also, why does the church declare a separation of validly married couple? So sometimes, let's say the couple, they are married and they are in a sacrament, so they can never, you know, if the sacrament is last as long as both are alive. But it can happen that one of the spouse, the spouse commit adultery, or left the Catholic faith, become a heretic, or become violent, want to kill their wife. Then the church allows separation in those exceptional circumstances. The commitment to live together as husband and wife is a serious commitment. Unless there's a serious reason, you know, they shouldn't be just separate that easy. But the church do acknowledge sometimes you have to separate because of a really serious situation.
But you're still married.
You are still married.
Yeah, they don't.
And then also, sometimes, you know, of course, the church doesn't allow the divorce. As I say, if people file a divorce to attack the marriage bond, you know, then it's sinful. Sometimes people might file a divorce to legally protect oneself. You know, let's say the spouse gone crazy, violent, and then also maybe using money recklessly. You know, so the spouse have to protect oneself. But it's not for the sake of attacking the marriage bond. And then the next page is about impediment of marriage. Some impediment can be so serious, some obstacle of getting married is so serious that it will make a marriage to be invalid, no marriage at all. Some will be, make the marriage unlawful, but it's still a true marriage. So, some of them will be, if you are married already, you know, that would be an impediment. If they don't give their consent freely, you know, if you are being forced, you know, somebody say, you married my daughter or else, okay, that can be an impediment because you are not really free. Lack of age. For the whole church, the universal age for marriage is a young man must be at least 16 and a young lady must be at least 14. That's for the universal church.
Still?
For the whole church. Because in some country, you know, they marry in really young, right? In some country. So the law is for the whole church. I think in Canada, it's either 18 or 19 is the age for legally in the church to marry. I think it's 18 in Canada.
18,
yeah. Blood relationship. You know, close relative, you cannot get married each other. You know. Close affinity, relationship by marriage. The survivor cannot marry the blood relations of a dead spouse. In a direct line as a stepdaughter or mother-in-law, no dispensation is granted. Then sometimes it can be second degree, can be a dispense. If you are a priest, a deacon, or months or religious, you cannot marry. If it is a bad marriage between a baptized person and a non-baptized person, it's usually an impediment. But if the Catholic party promised to do his best, to maintain the faith in the family, then the dispensation will be can be granted to marry a non-Catholic. So there's something. It's quite often when we prepare people to get married, we ask for dispensation for people who are not baptized. And then spiritual affinity is no longer have that impediment. In the good old days, if you are the godparent of someone, you and that person have a spiritual relationship like a father and a parent and a child, then you cannot get married to each other. And then it's a minor impediment, so you need to get a dispensation before you get married. Legal relationship. So if you are adopted brother and sister, you cannot get married to each other. Okay. So, that's an idea. Some impediment. And then sometimes simple vows, you know, can be impediment. Mixed religion. A baptized Catholic marry a baptized Protestant can be an impediment. But that can be asked for a permission to do that. Okay. And then sometimes, you know, the church can grant a dispensation of impediment, as I mentioned. Some of the blood relation not too close can be disbanded. Or if in the old days, if somebody is somebody's godparent, it can be disbanded. And sometimes if you marry a person that's not a Catholic, that can ask for dispensation. So basically, it's to encourage you to have those relationships, but if that happens, the church will grant it, if for good reason, the church will relax the law and give dispensation. And it's also mentioned that, such a defect in the marriage, the church can declare a marriage to be null and void, no marriage at all. Okay. What should Catholic do to prepare a holy and happy marriage? Okay, for those who are not married, okay, listen to that one. First, pray that God may direct their choice. Okay, rejecting choice by blind choice should be directed by God, you know, direct the choice. Second, seek the advice of their parents and confessors. Third, practice the virtues, especially chastity. Fourth, frequently receive the sacraments of penance and Holy Eucharist. Makes sense? And then courtship. If you are dating, it should be from discerning to get married with that person. So you should not just dating for the sake of dating. It's something to discern the marriage. So shouldn't be too young to date. If you are only 12 years old, doesn't make sense to date. You know, when you are closer to the marriage age, that's time to date. You know, but you know, elementary school, no, don't even think about that. Okay, yeah. So and then also when you are dating, try to really pray that you can have a good practicing Catholic, a good character. Make a good companion and help her in life. Don't pick a criminal, you know. Okay. One can better judge the character and virtues of a future spouse at church and in the home than on the floor in the ballrooms. The advice choose your partner at the communion well is very sad. So. Yeah, so if you are basically talking about when you are having people that you know in church, and you know that will be healthier. You just go to the places that are immoral places, you know, to try to find your life partner. That's not quite the right place, you know. It is wrong and foolish to marry for beauty, riches, or honors alone. We should rather seek and chiefly seek the quality of a person's soul. And then engagement is a mutual promise of marriage, implying marriage at an early date. Should not last longer than a few months. I think nowadays people have long engagement, you know.
2 years?
Huh?
6 months to 2 years.
Today for 6 months to 2 years. That's a bit short nowadays.
Yeah.
I dated for 10 months and I didn't make it. It's either 6 months I would be, I'm stuck forever.
Wow.
No, I think maybe it's that in the older days people mature faster, right? Now the people, you know, people finish university at the age of 26, you know, is I think people not much mature as fast as before, you know, is so you know, I think 6 months would be just way too fast, you know. I think a lot of time when you fall in love with somebody, you know, the first 6 months is like taking drugs. And then 6 months later, you sober up, and then you know what you're doing, you know. And then it's like after dating for 6 months, then I start to think about maybe I did being called to be a priest, you know. And then so after 10 months, then I decided, you know, okay, we have to break the relationship, I have to become a priest, you know. So I think 6 months is just too fast, you know. You are still in the honeymoon age, you know, day stage, you know. You are not reasoning rightly. You're in drugs, you know, at that time. It's just not right.
That's just, he bailed out.
Huh? We met and got married in 7 months.
Huh? Okay. No. That's really fast. Yeah.
1 month.
7 years. Anyhow, you got your chance to think about that, and you did think about that again.
Unless you take into account the second
marriage. Yeah, that's 13 years of dating. Yeah. Okay, now I think it's important, you know, when people are dating, it's important to remember you don't actually own the other person yet, you know. So there should be respect. You know, that's respect and modesty and chastity, really important. So you know, it's important. I think it's important for dating couple to be chaste while they are dating. You know, to avoid being alone and doing nothing. You know, really important. Those common sense. And then also, the time between engagement and marriage, you know, should carefully consider the step they are about to take. And make good preparation for their wedding day, their wedded life by frequently employing God's blessing. So I think it's just important to remember that marriage is not just a beautiful big celebration or a big party. It's a spiritual reality. It's a lifelong commitment, and you actually give yourself to each other completely. You know, you are being united by God in a bond that is really, really strong. It only can be destroyed by death. So when you are united to another person so closely in life, you know, you better pick your spouse carefully, you know, because you will be with that person for the rest of your life. You better to be really, really, really careful to pick the spouse carefully. Because once you are married, that you belong, you are completely given to the other person, and you accept the other person completely. There's no turning back, and so that commitment is not something to make lightly. It's a serious commitment, but it's a holy commitment. So it's something that should do that with the help of God, with the help of grace, yeah. So and then basically the other is about I would just finish that later, you know. It's just too many chapters on marriage in this book. They have a few on holy order, so many on marriage. Not fair. Okay, we'll stop here.